Welcome to the UFO Files Show with your host, Jerry Pippin.
It's Jerry Pippin, and we are at the Ozark UFO Festival. I call it a festival because it's kind of a fun place to come, Eureka Springs. And actually, there's a lot of serious UFO research that goes on, and we have one of the most serious of the researchers, maybe not in real life, but in your presentations, Richard Dolan. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Jerry. Thanks.
It's always good having you on and talking about some of your work. And you talked about excessive secrecy, I think, here.
Yeah.
That's in connection with the UFO issue.
That's always my thing. I always talk about UFO secrecy. And in this case, today I was really dealing with trying to understand the structure of secrecy a little bit better than I've maybe done in the past. And it was a difficult presentation in a way. I really tried to understand the nature of transnational power. And just asking the question, who's in control? I think most people will agree that probably the president isn't in control of UFO secrecy, but if it isn't the president, then who would it be? And so I was really trying to explore some of those issues. And
well, you brought up an interesting point there. I think it's probably not the president.
Yeah, I think most people don't think it's the president, which is kind of funny because in American society we like to think of the president as the top guy, but I don't think any UFO researcher that I know actually believes that the president's got all the cards here. So,
and we keep hearing stories about certain presidents asking for information from particular cabinet members here and there, even confidants in their pre-election when they get there, and et cetera, et cetera.
Right.
People they trust, and we hear stories like, well, they won't tell me, or other incidents. For instance, the story about Bush on his last day with the CIA or whatever said, "Hey, I'm not going to tell you."
Right, with Jimmy Carter. Right,
yeah,
exactly.
Right.
Well, some people have disputed the details of that story, but it is true that George Bush
did brief
Carter. It was his last
day, so I guess you could say that.
It was toward the end of his tenure. Ford had appointed Bush as head of CIA for 1976, and when Carter came in, it was a briefing that Bush did give Carter in November of 1976. I forget the date, but he did brief him. So the real question is, what did they talk about? There is the claim that part of it was regarding UFO secrecy and or the UFO phenomenon. And that story has come to us through Marcia Smith and Dan Sheehan. And then other people say, well, that's just urban legend. But well, I would suspect that Bush would have had a UFO thing with Carter.
Well, basically, my point was, whether it was his last day or 3 months before he actually left or whenever.
Yeah.
The point was, Bush could probably say that because he wasn't appointed by him. But later on, you hear stories about people like you make them CIA director. Mm-hmm. You call them back in later, and they say, "Well, I'm sorry, Mr. President, I can't tell you that." I tell you, every politician I met has a big ego, and I wouldn't put up with that. If I had somebody I appointed, and they said, "Well, I can't tell you that," I'd say, "Well, fine, you're fired."
Most definitely.
Yeah. Your take on all that?
This seems to be the case frequently. I remember talking with former Assistant Secretary of HUD, Catherine Austin Fitz. She's talked to lots of people about this, and one of the stories she often will say is that when she first came into HUD in 1989, and she was a financial whiz, this was her thing, and one of her first things was to say, "Look, I want to look at the budget." And she was told, "Sorry, ma'am, you know, you're really not authorized to see the budget." She's the second in charge at HUD, and she's this financial, and they couldn't show her the budget. They finally did. It took months, she said, and they finally wheeled in, you know, carts and carts of stacks of paper, and that's how she was supposed to go through it. But, you know, a lot of these government officials, the elected ones, you get the idea that they are not encouraged to take an active role in a lot of the information of their department.
Yeah, well, I understand, and probably a lot of them would just as soon not get into any of these details.
Yeah, right.
But but not all of them. Somebody's bound to know something.
Yes, I agree. And the question is, regarding the UFO issue, who knows what and where do they know it? One of the things that I've tried to look into on my own limited basis is special access programs within the Department of Defense. One of the things that I mentioned today was, this appears to be an area, a key area, where there's just absolutely no oversight at all by Congress, and where there's the potential for huge amounts of money to go through these programs. For instance, shortly before 9/11, Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld, this is in July of 2001, was speaking to the House Appropriations Committee regarding the upcoming fiscal year budget for the Pentagon. Rumsfeld, toward the end of his interview with the House, made a statement that still astonishes me to this day, which is that he was talking about how messed up the accounting system at the Pentagon was, how they needed more accounting support. And he said, the books are so screwed up that we cannot account for $2.6 trillion in transactions, he said, if that's believable. That's a direct quote from Rumsfeld. I'm not making this up.
One can look this up.
So then the question is, when you consider that the Pentagon's fiscal year budget for 2001 was $310 billion, all right, this is a factor of 8. How is it even possible to lose 8 times your annual budget? Am I missing something here? How can one do that, and where would that money go? Where would it come from? I don't know, but there's a lot of money that seems to be missing. Regarding special access programs within the Pentagon, all that we really know about them is that there's a couple of hundred, apparently, and that they have no congressional oversight, that they have their own security systems. It's my strongly held opinion that at least one, probably more, but certainly at least one of these special access programs is directly related to the UFO issue. That is ET technology study, and probably study of bodies as well, and that this is a special access program. One thing we know about a lot of these SAPs is that they appear to have the most power is in the hands of the contracting organization, not necessarily the Pentagon itself, like contractors.
Sure.
And so
I've had a feeling for a long time that this is either the unintended consequence or the real consequence of avoiding freedom of information, lots of other things. You turn it over to a corporation.
Yeah,
somebody.
Right.
You got another layer there.
Right. And this is what I think's been happening as well. This is kind of my theme today. So, when you're really trying to get at these secrets, as one person implied, this problem is not necessarily classified so much as proprietary at this point. So, in other words, if you're dealing with actual retrieved objects that are under study, maybe it's more likely to think of these as going into the hands of private entities for study, which would then mean that they're beyond federal control, they're beyond our formal government control. And then how does the public get access to information about this? It becomes very difficult.
And like I say, that's either by design or the unintended consequences of doing it.
Yeah, but maybe a little bit of both.
In
government, the government people are all dominated by these exact same financial corporate interests. Just look at one typical body that conspiracy theorists love to talk about, and correctly so, and that's the Council on Foreign Relations. This is a body of about 3,000 people who come from the highest levels of finance and industry, and they are absolutely probably the dominant philosophical foreign policy body that we have in this country. I mean, they've essentially swallowed up the State Department or vice versa, and they're all representatives of industry. So that the U.S. government has been dominated by these elements since forever, and so it would make sense to me that a lot of the secret would go private into those very same organizations.
And you mentioned the $2.3 trillion missing. My understanding is I think there's still missing even more now.
So. Oh, I would have to assume. And that number, by the way, has been reported once as $2.6 trillion, once as $2.3 trillion.
Okay.
A couple of billion here, a couple of billion there.
Yeah,
who knows?
After a while, as Dirksen said, exactly. You're talking about real money.
Exactly. One thing that Catherine Fitz was writing about in one of her articles called What's Up with the Black Budget, it's an easy internet search, was the disappearance of $3.3 trillion from 98 to 2001, the last 3 years of the Clinton administration, not just from the Defense Department, but from the whole government. Now, I mean, you can study her argument in her article, I suppose. But the point is that there's apparently a lot, an enormous amount of missing money. I mean, the U.S. annual budget is something about $2.5 trillion a year, I think. So if you're missing $2 and $3 trillions of dollars at a time, something's not right here.
that's an understatement.
And the thing that the UFO tie-in, as I see it, is, look, we know that this is an important program, and yet if you study the U.S. annual budget...
There's nothing there, in there.
No, there's
there.
Nothing. Who's going to pay for UFO studies, right?
I don't even see $1.95 for UFO research.
But there's got to be money going into it. One would have to reason. So so the assumption has to be that it's going through some black budget channels. And
well, you made a career trying to find out these secrets and at least investigate and put together some deductive thinking.
Yeah, that's about what all I can do. I mean, you can become acquainted with the facts as well as you can, and you get some leaked information where you can, but really what I try to do is just reason it out myself to the best of my ability.
And what's your latest project? You got
trying
a
to
book?
Finish, I'm finishing my next book. It's been the thing that's been hanging over my head since my first book came out. So this is UFOs and the National Security State, Volume 2. It's a long, long project. It's a lot longer than my first book. The first book was a straightforward history covering from the 1940s to the early 70s. Volume 2 is taking it to the present day, so for the last 35 years or so. And whereas the first book's about 500 pages long, this second book I'm predicting will not be less than 700 pages. It's a
big book.
It's a lot. And the good news is that the research is all finished. I finished that over a year ago. And I'm actually actively writing the narrative, trying to get this thing done, hopefully get it done before the end of the year.
Yeah, a lot of people, and I don't know exactly how you work, but I imagine it's pretty similar. You go out and you do this research, and you get the facts, and to a lot of people that sounds like that's the toughest part of the job, and maybe it is, but I find... coming back and trying to put it into some sort of semblance where people will understand it and where I understand it,
yeah.
That's where all of a sudden you get weighted down.
Well, that's a really good point. The research was a huge part of my undertaking. I have to be honest. When I finished that first book, I had very limited knowledge of the more recent UFO history. I really had to spend some time to get up to speed on that. I feel that I've done that and that I've got a very good handle on it, but it took me some time. But I agree with you that organizing the notes and then trying to write this story in a way so that it's that it makes sense and that it's engaging to the reader and that it, you know, moves this narrative along and as yet does justice to all the facts, it's always this balancing act and it's tricky. It's something that I enjoy as a writer, though, actually.
Well,
I do
sure.
enjoy
it. It's a nice challenge. I like to do investigative pieces and... The thing I think about when I started organizing this and present a narrative is, am I missing something? And usually I am.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, we always miss something. When I wrote my first book, I absolutely knew that there was going to be some big thing that I would just get wrong. And in fact, yes, I mean, there was one thing on my first book that I truly wish I had handled a little differently. But look, you know, what can you do?
You can find out more information about the book that we're talking about right on our website. We have a link over so you can order it. And in addition to that, we'll be right back to talk to Richard Dolan about more UFO secrets. I want to find out if he's got something that's, you know, he wanted to come up to speed. Maybe he's found something that he didn't expect. Who knows? We'll find out in a minute.
The biggest secret ever is about to be revealed. Fast Walkers, UFO and Alien Disclosure.
Words you were never meant to hear.
It's clear we're dealing with a cosmic Watergate.
This is the biggest secret in the history of the human race, the known modern history of government.
Photos you were never meant to see. radio you never knew existed. People you were never meant to meet.
As Jack Nicholson would say, you can't handle the truth.
Essentially everything that you would want to know has been covered up.
Things you were never meant to know about.
No one has produced a higher quality, better produced DVD. Anytime, anywhere. Fast Walkers now available on DVD for only $19.95 at ShopJerryPippin.com. We are at Eureka Springs at the end of the Ozarks. I'm Jerry Pippin. Richard Dolan is our guest. And Richard, when do you think this book might come out?
I'm very hopeful, Jerry, that it will be out by the end of this year, 2007. I'm busting my behind out to get this thing finished.
And the title of the book will be?
UFOs and the National Security State, Volume 2.
Volume 2.
Well, it's big enough to be a volume.
Yeah.
So 1974, it'll be right up to 2007. Whatever day I finish writing that book,
we've been doing a lot of shows here about lots of interesting things. And we talk about the 50s and 60s, but there's been some incidents since 1974, I'm sure, that jump out at you.
Many, many. Some are well known to the research community, others less so. Certainly one of the big events was from the early part, 1975, where we had in this country an incredible series of violations of military airspace all along the northern U.S. border, going out from Montana out to Maine over a very short period of time. These have been written about and described by other researchers, and it's not much of a need to review it all here, except that it was an absolutely awesome and still unexplained series of events. One thing that I noticed from 1975, it really is going to go down, in my view, as one of the single most important years in the history of UFO in the modern times. Right,
really?
Up there with 1947, yeah, and 1952. And the reason is, not only do you have because something big happened this year. We've got the airspace violation.
You're talking about 1975.
There was also, this is the year for the first time that we had a definite wave of absolutely identifiable triangle sightings. And this happened in North Carolina in April 1975. For an entire week, you had large numbers of witnesses. Now, there were triangle sightings previous to 1975, but there was never an extended, concentrated series of sightings until this time. I mean, if you go back into the database of, say, the National UFO Reporting Center, you can find triangle sightings that go back earlier. But this is a definite wave. Over 50 witnesses, many of whom were police officers, saw perfect triangular craft flying low, exhibiting very remarkable maneuverability, extreme acceleration, silent, you know, intense bright white light coming down from it. I mean, standard UFO type stuff. So that, in other words, you have the introduction of the triangles. In addition, there were some absolutely spectacular abduction cases. Everyone knows about the Travis Walton case. There were a couple of others from 1975 that were very, very interesting. And then also, 1975 is the year that the cattle mutilation phenomenon really absolutely just spiked and took off. There had been mutes before this, but 1975 was the year. It was also the year that we started getting large numbers of reports of unmarked black helicopters, often in connection with these mutilation sites. So when I look at the whole thing as, you know, the gestalt of that year, it's an extraordinary year. Something big was happening, it seems to me. I have a hard time seeing these as unrelated, separate phenomena. In particular, when you consider that the mutilations, the black helicopters, and a number of the airspace violations that I was talking about occurred in very close proximity to each other. Something was happening in 1975, and
you can't put your finger on it, though, or can you?
No, I mean, I wonder, you know, is there a single unifying cause? The only thing that I can say is that it was a definite act on the part of those operating the UFOs themselves. which I believe were aliens. I don't think this is, like, for example, I think that the airspace violations were not a human event. I think that this is alien. And so there was something that they were doing at that time that was very important.
You look back at the history, 1975.
Not necessarily a big year. America pulled out of Vietnam. Okay, that's something, I guess, but really, what does it mean? No, there was not any huge major news that year. But yet, in the history of UFO study, it's very important. The other thing that I've noticed, like, through the years, is the ups and downs of UFO secrecy. This is something I tracked in my first book, and this is something that I track in the forthcoming book. So, for example, one of the things that I find very interesting is how every decade, from the 70s and the 80s and 90s and our own decade here in the 21st century, there are these movements to end UFO secrecy. Now, in the late 70s, it was the kind of aftermath of Watergate and the Freedom of Information Act, which had been very much liberalized. And then you have the Carter administration, which promoted a fairly liberal interpretation of FOIA. And at that time, a lot of researchers got really excited, and they're thinking, this is going to be we're going to use this tool to end secrecy and yank those UFO documents out of the government. Well, it didn't happen because we weren't able to get really the most secret documents out. Most of the classifications that came out were of lower levels of secrecy. Still, there was that hope. That hope was dashed by the early 80s. Then, in the late 1980s, once again, there was this hope that was raised with the revelations about Area 51. People talking about the Groom Lake facility and these leaks coming out. And again, what you find in the UFO research community was this expectation that something's going to give. In 87, in fact, there was that special UFO cover-up live. Hosted by Mike Farrell.
In 87, I was broadcasting in Las Vegas, and we were doing UFO shows. Another guy with me was as well, and we all thought things would break.
That was a big thing. And I was 25 years old. I knew nothing about UFOs, but I saw that special. Uh-huh. And I remembered the same thing everyone else remembered about that, which was that the aliens liked Tibetan music and strawberry ice cream.
Right.
Remember that?
Strawberry ice cream still hangs around.
It sure does. But the thing was that by the late 80s, there was this feeling that something was going to break. And then you get it
in
the
90s. No, a
guy I
worked with took a bus full of people up to Groom Lake, Area 51, and they let him in there for a while. Finally, they blocked it. But it wasn't as super secret as it is now. They could see facilities from there.
I mean, a large portion of the land was purchased by the Air Force in the early 90s. And made a lot harder for people to do that.
In fact, he even thought about it, and I guess there are some charters that go up that way anyway, but he was thinking about really running the real thing for a while. The point I'm making is that Area 51, that we thought that was going to happen, it didn't happen.
Right. There were initiatives through the 90s. When Clinton became elected president, there was the Lawrence Rockefeller Initiative. Lawrence Rockefeller had a very strong interest in UFOs, and tried to promote some open study on this, and people got excited about this again, and it looked like, maybe there's something that will happen. And really what happened out of that was the Air Force Roswell report and the Mogul hypothesis, which really dashed all of that. And then you get the whole disclosure movement in the wake of that in the late 90s and up to the press conference of 2001. Sure. Once again, this ramp up of expectation that the secret's going to come out, and of course it did not. So I guess one of the subplots that I track in this new book is this, you could look at it as a series of failures if you want to have UFO secrecy ended, can look at it as a series of persistence and
maybe getting a little further each time.
That's right. I mean, it's a situation in which every decade witnesses this kind of push to end the secrecy. And just like a hockey game, you're not going to score unless you get a lot of shots on goal. So maybe we need a lot of attempts to end this secrecy before something actually does give.
What do you think the future is for disclosure? On the surface right now, it kind of appears that something might be brewing.
It does appear.
But we've
that way,
had
yes.
that way. We've had those feelings before.
It's
you
happened.
Just laid down the litany. Right.
It's been happening, and this is why I never get overly worked up when I hear these rumors. Although it's true, there are reasons to suspect that something can happen this time, but I suspect it won't. But I do believe that within the next, I would say within 20 years it will happen, maybe even within 10. And the reason I think that it's very possible is that another thing I've noticed is that UFO secrets have a tendency of coming out in a nation when there's been a major regime change or a lot of political turmoil. For example, in the mid-70s when Franco died in Spain, that resulted directly in the release of a lot of UFO-sensitive documents. When Mao died in China, same thing, basically. After we had Watergate, our own crisis, we had Freedom of Information Act, that made some differences. When the Soviet Union was in a state of collapse, there was a brief period when a lot of UFO-sensitive data came out. And so it seems to me that there are opportunities within a society when there's a high level of instability. And I do believe that the United States is in a point where we are very, very close to that position. You've got an enormous backlash to this war that is brewing and growing daily. At some point,
so
the stuff is going
to
hit the fan.
Just to change the subject.
Well, maybe that, but I'm even thinking that when there's turmoil, there are opportunities for insiders to release information. I guess that's what
I'm saying. In other words, the control is not as strong because they're preoccupied with something.
That's what I believe, yes.
Yeah.
And
that,
look, no government is monolithic. There's always factions within a group. And so, I mean, we all know that there are people who are very sympathetic to the release of this information. They just don't feel that they have the opportunity to do it. So my suspicion, my hope is that if there is such a crisis here, and I think that that's a real chance, that there may be, release of some kind of information.
Well, Richard Dolan, I think that's a good way for us to leave this discussion.
Great.
On an optimistic note.
Yeah, for a change.
Yeah. always good to see you again. You're looking
Same
good.
Here. Thank
and,
you.
Look forward to the book coming out.
Appreciate
By
it.
By the end of the year, we'll hold you to that.
Oh, don't hold me, but I'm doing my best. I said before I said it'd be the end of 06, and that didn't happen. So.
Yeah. Well, it's slipping a little. Kind of like some of my shows I do.
It.
Well, it'll be on next
That's
week,
right.
honestly. thanks very much, Richard.
Thank you.
This
Appreciate
is Jerry
it.
Pippin. We're in Eureka Springs.
Okay, thank you very much.
Major sighting here.
On the 13th of March, weird happenings in the skies over Phoenix recently. And no one seems to be able to explain what it was.
And now, suddenly six amber orbs in a row, totally equidistant from each other, massive span across, pop up.
People say they saw strange lights.
A series of strange bright lights seen over the skies of Arizona gets a lot of people wondering.
There are another 10,000 Arizonans who saw the same thing.
Eyewitnesses who saw it say it's like nothing they've ever seen before.
Last night, shortly after 8 p.m., hundreds, maybe thousands of Arizonans reported seeing a triangular-shaped object with three to
thousands of people saw more than stars in the night sky.
The mystery remains unsolved and controversial.
There was nothing there.
The award-winning documentary by Dr. Lynn Kita, The Phoenix Lights, is now available from shopjerrypippin.com. Order now. Supplies limited.
Of course, in Eureka Springs at the Ozark UFO Conference, and our good friend Don Ware, who we just saw in Laughlin. And Don, you promised to come by and tell me your Bigfoot story in detail. We talked a little bit about it. We never really got into it. Why don't you kind of fill our audience in on what we're talking about here?
All right. I live in Okaloosa County, Florida, which is adjacent to where the middle of Eglin Air Force Base is, which is a big reservation. It's 52 miles east to west, 20 miles north to south. Nobody's going to build a house in. And they've got about half of that territory is restricted from all humans, they tell us, because of possible unexploded ordnance. Not open to hunting or anything. So on the west side of me is Santa Rosa County, where Gulf Breeze is, and as the Florida MUFON state director. I was kind of running the investigation of Ed Walters and the Gulf Breeze sightings, and I'm also a birder. I was the bird count coordinator for Choctachi Audubon Society.
Oh, really?
And
yeah, you're finding my
card says truth seeker and birder. Okay. I've been a truth seeker for since I was 16 and a birder since I was 7.
You see?
But I got a phone call from a scoutmaster. He said, who has the responsibility of investigating a Bigfoot sighting? And I said, well, I think it's a non-game species. It's probably the state regional non-game wildlife biologist. And he said, well, how do I get a hold of him? I said, well, I work with him frequently on bird issues. So I gave him his phone number.
Okay.
And he called the state non-game wildlife biologist who lived 70 miles to the east in Panama City. And he agreed that, yeah, it was his responsibility. Bigfoot is apparently a non-game species. He then called me, because I guess the scoutmaster told him I was the one that gave him the number. So he called me.
Came back to you.
And asked if I would assist him in the investigation of the Bigfoot sightings in Walton County. Walton County is a county to the east, between me and Panama City, where this other guy lived. So I told him, I asked him first, this is Jeffrey Gore, the state regional non-game wildlife biologist. Mm-hmm. I said, does the state have a cryptozoology file to keep the records of all the information gathered on the skunk ape in the Everglades, or the Bowden Booger in the forest of eastern Florida, or the other Bigfoot reports that have come from the panhandle of Florida? And he says, no, the state does not have a cryptozoology file. And I said, well, I'm an experienced investigator of unidentified objects. I will prepare some forms for a proper investigation of these Bigfoot sightings if you will promise me that you will establish a cryptozoology file to keep the information always available at both regional level and at state level. And he promised me he would do that. And I know very well that, you know, Jim Cox, who is a state non-game wildlife biologist, and he agreed. So I said, all right, we'll do that. And I worked with the scoutmaster to set up the interviews of the witnesses. And the night before we had the primary interviews set up, he called me and he said, look, I just got sent downstate. Florida's a big state. It's about 8 days.
Sure, sure.
Can you handle the interviews without me, or do we have to reschedule? And I said, well, I think between the two of us, you know, in MUFON, we always like to have two people working the interviews. I said, I think between the two of us, we can do that. This was 1987.
Okay.
The same time I was investigating the big, you know, this, yeah, our investigation of this, interviews and all were in December, the month after the Gulf Breeze sighting started big time. And so I was going one way one time and the other way, the next day. And we found a 13-year-old boy who was walking down a dirt path at 10 o'clock in the morning with a walking stick. And he comes past a young magnolia tree that has thick leaves. And as he walks by the tree on one side, a 9-foot male Bigfoot walks past the tree on the other side. They're about 10 feet apart when they spot each other.
Wow.
and they both just freeze.
Okay.
And the kid drops, he said he dropped his walking stick and was just looking at this Bigfoot guy who was kind of in mid-stride.
Yeah.
And he's just froze there. And then after about 30 seconds, the Bigfoot guy just turns 90 degrees to the side and looks down on him. I mean, this guy is 9 feet tall.
Yeah,
he's looking down
on
this 13-year-old kid. And they stood there and looked at each other, he said, for about 5 minutes.
Wow.
He could describe every hair on his body. He described it, generally it's long, dark brown hair. Mm-hmm. And the skin, he had no hair under the eyebrows. you know, around the eyes. Right. It was just black skin. The nose had no hair on it, just black skin. The lips were black skin. The palms of his hands were black skin with no hair, as were the bottoms of his feet. Everything else was covered in. He said he could see fingernails, not from the top, because the fingernails were covered with the hair, but from the bottom he could see that he had fingernails. And he said his eyes reminded him of giant gerbil eyes, just big brown orbs, no whites. And they sat there and looked at each other, and then the guy just turned and walked away, and he could see the ripple of the muscles in the buttocks and all that. It wasn't a guy in a monkey suit, you know.
Didn't make any noises during that time?
Didn't make any noises, but I measured the tracks, and from left heel to white, I mean, the footprints sunk into that sandy soil about 3 inches. Whereas I had a 300-pound man stand beside it, and he hardly made a dent in the sand. This was a heavy beast, I tell you. The male foot is 17 and a half inches long, 8 inches wide, and on this creature, the little toe on the right foot was sticking almost straight out to the side as if it had been broken. And the distance between left heel and right heel was 84 inches. Now, I don't know at that particular time whether he was just walking or whether he was running, but it didn't appear to me that he was running. I didn't see a big indentation in the toe.
This was a big dude, but a big stride.
Big dude, right. So the other information we found is that the female tracks is another set of tracks, which we understand are female tracks that were 16 inches long, 8 inches wide. The little toe on the left foot was missing. Just wasn't there.
Wow.
And very distinctive tracks. We interviewed the nearest farmer who told us that when they were building the dam on the river there, building the dam for a lake on the river, they had bulldozers and moved a lot of dirt, and there was a lot of bare dirt there. And he said he saw those same distinctive tracks with the little toe missing on the smaller one and the, you know, in 1959. Now, this was 87. So they've been there a long time.
The boy, he didn't see the female.
He didn't see the female.
Okay.
No.
The female tracks were around.
The other tracks were around. It appears to be a pair because in 1991, these tracks kept coming through their place every year. The father of the boy thought that they migrated seasonally up the river valleys from this place, you know, where they could have cover, and came back just to get a change of scenery. But generally, they were living in North Walton, in the Eglin Reservation, you know, the swamps of Tie Tie Creek and those places in the Eglin Reservation, in that restricted area, most of the year. So the guy said his dog is never afraid of anything until Bigfoot is around, and then he won't go out of the house. He's very afraid, you know, his behavior is he's afraid. The mother of this kid said that she was canoeing with the young sister, who was maybe 4 or 5 years old at the time, and the young girl in the front of the canoe was facing her mother, facing backwards. And she was paddling, and she saw the eyes of the young girl get about the size of a saucer, looking back over her shoulder. And so she looked back over there, and all she saw was ripples in the water, as if something had just gone down. And the daughter was incapable of describing what she saw. And so the mother got the daughter to draw a picture. And she drew a picture of this brown, you know, dark brownish, moundish thing that looked like a head with no shoulders and a head and shoulders of something that apparently was holding its breath as the canoe went by and came up behind the canoe and saw that the daughter was looking that way and went back down real quick after it got a breath. And that picture was made before the son, the brother had had that experience. We found the closest house to that area was actually a trailer home, I think. But the lady was raising parrots. She worked in the math lab at Eglin Air Force Base. And she came home, you know, within a few days of this event. And the cages of her parrots had been open. There was some brown, long brown hair stuck on one of the wire, one of the doorways to the wire cage, and there were several of her parrots running around the yard with no tails. Something had gone in, taken her parrots out, and pulled the tails off of them. And we don't know what would do that unless the Bigfoot creature might have done that. Maybe he was just attracted by the tail feathers of these green parrots.
In other words, they were still alive.
Yeah, they were still alive.
Missing the tail feathers.
There were a couple of the parrots were missing altogether, whether they got away or flew away or what. But those that were still there may have had the wings pinioned or something, didn't have any tails.
There's no doubt about it, Don, in your mind, that these people were telling you the truth. You measured the tracks. You saw them.
I've had some practice in determining whether people are telling me the truth in investigations of strange objects. Yeah, one of the people we interviewed was driving a car. He was 18 years old. He was driving a car 7 miles west of the original sighting. At about dusk, he's doing 55 miles an hour. He comes around a curve and he sees this tall, hairy creature start to cross the road in front of him. He got off the gas. He passed this creature about 6 feet from him, doing 45 miles an hour. He had his lights on, even though it was just dusk. He said there was something white on the front of him. Now the kid had described a little white triangular mark on the chin, looked like it kind of reminded him of a goatee, and a white blaze that started in the middle of the chest and widened out and then came to an end down near the groin. Well, this guy said he saw something white on the front, but the creature just turned around and walked back into the woods as he was passing him. So that was 7 days later and 7 miles farther west. We have reports in the little towns along the north edge of the Eglin Reservation of something reaching over the fence of a pig pen and taking a pig and running off with it. And then that happened in Holt, and it happened in Mossy Head. In Holt, with that report, was back from the 50s. In Mossy Head, it was in the early 80s or mid 80s. I was working with the sheriff of the county on these reports, on finding, sightings and stuff. And he called me and he said, I just had an incident that you're probably interested in. He said, there's a guy up here raises pit bulls. And something grabbed a hold of one of his pit bulls and ripped the arms and legs off of it. He says, no man did that. We know from the literature that Bigfoot has a tendency to take saplings about the size of your wrist and twist the tops off 6 feet above the ground. There were saplings like that in areas where you can't get machinery to in the area of these sightings. So we have a lot of evidence that Bigfoot is there. And what's more interesting is some emails and phone calls I've gotten in the past 3 weeks.
Oh, really? Something current here.
Because, actually several months ago, I got an email from a fella in Panama City, who said that he works with a lady who likes to hunt. And she was hunting on private property north of Panama City. And the lady that owned the property had some animals. And something was disturbing her animals, and she wanted to know what it was. So this hunter friend of my friend, True Seeker friend, Carlos, had camera traps that they use, to set up on hunting trails to see what's there. And they got a full frontal view of a female Bigfoot on camera. And if we got one more minute.
I do have it.
Recently, very recently, I got two reports of a Bigfoot sighting seen on US 90. I think it was between Argyle and Ponce de Leon, just inside of, I think it's Holmes County. And this is 14 miles from the initial sightings I told you about.
Right, okay.
The one in Bay County is 40 miles east of what I was telling you about. But the whole area is very swampy and very lowly populated. It's good Bigfoot habitat. Lots of swampy lakes in there. Well, anyway, they were driving down the road, and a Bigfoot creature caused them to wreck the car. And the wife of the guy in the car got a picture of this Bigfoot. And I'm told now that a copy of that picture was given to the sheriff's office as part of the accident report. And that was late last year, late 2006. And then an acquaintance of that guy had seen a Bigfoot at that exact spot about 1 year earlier in 2005. So I'm in the process of trying to get more information on those sightings. Hopefully I'll get two pictures of the Bigfoot creatures.
Yeah, I was starting to say, we've got to stay in touch with you, though, on that deal. Yep. Yeah, you haven't seen either picture yet.
I haven't seen, no, they're very reluctant because they're afraid if the authorities see these pictures, you know, they're liable to declare this an endangered or a threatened species and restrict the use of their property where these things have been photographed. So that's one of the big problems we have with the landowners.
Now the wreck, the Bigfoot came out and they tried to dodge it or something?
I don't have all the details. Okay. This is a third-hand story that I've got.
We're talking about Bigfoot stories that started some time back, and they're still going on right there in your area of Florida.
That's right. And then I followed up. I was working on the Breeding Bird Atlas Project in Florida, so I got an opportunity over in the next county to talk to the father of this young man. He says that kid has now seen Bigfoot on 7 occasions. Apparently they like him. They're interacting with him. They're allowing him to see them. And he said that that the tracks come through every year, and in 1991 there was a third set of tracks with this Bigfoot couple that was 8 inches long, 6 inches
wide. So they have a child now.
Yeah. So the Bigfoot that was seen on 90, just 14 miles west of that, or east of that, recently, is, they say, is 6.5 feet tall. And I'm wondering if this guy was born around 1990 or so, would he be about 6.5 feet tall now?
You said the regular Bigfoot's probably about 9 feet?
The male was 9 feet tall. The male is 9 feet tall, and we think the female is at least 8 feet probably. It's
so
big.
So this
one that's been photographed recently may be the young of the same family, but I just don't have the pictures to verify that.
We'll be talking to you from time to time and seeing you here and there.
Okay.
We'll keep us updated on Bigfoot. Thanks very much, Don.
Ware.
I'm Jerry Pippin.
Tales of the Strange and the Unknown. Every month in Fate Magazine.
Fate.
Fate Magazine has actually been published continuously since 1948. That makes it the longest running publication of its kind. From psychics and spiritualists, archaeological hotspots and fringe science, to authoritative UFO and paranormal investigations, Fate articles are factual, informative, and entertaining. Subscribe to Fate Magazine today. Simply go to FateMag.com, FateMag.com, or check it out at your local newsstand. Fate Magazine is a favorite for people looking for answers and for people looking for entertainment.
Fate.
Tales of the Strange and the Unknown.
We have Don Walton with us. And Walton, welcome to the show. You know, the interesting thing about you, Don, is that you're very distinctive. You got a cowboy hat on and Western outfit. I thought you were from Texas, but I guess Idaho Falls, huh?
That's correct. Yes,
Idaho. Well, you got a lot of things you want to. We need to talk to you about. One of the things is the fact that you've been abducted, and you think you're different, right? I mean, you're not. I don't want to say you're not human, but you were telling me at one time you even drank water with bleach at one time because you had bad water and it didn't bother you.
Well, I've done a lot of things like that. When I was riding motorcycles and stuff like that, I used to drink gasoline in order to kill the worms if you're eating raw meat because you don't have no place to cook when you're riding a Harley.
So I don't know how you do all that stuff. You're walking around. You're a healthy fellow. So maybe it would tell me why you think you're unusual.
Well,
you're writing a book, I know, and we don't want to give that away.
This is my first book. It took 5 years to put it together, but ever since I've been a young man, they've been taking me. And actually, they took me way before they ever took my cousin Travis. And when I was 10 years old, I went with them willingly because it was like an ET experience. They seemed more like they were friendly towards me. And I was never really abducted in my mind. I always thought that I was invited.
Okay.
And, you know, I believe that you're only abducted if you don't want to go. But I always wanted to go, so I figured it was just an invitation.
Now your mother was aware of this happening.
Well, yes. Yeah, she knew that there was nothing she could do about it, so what she would do is she would ask me to ask them questions about what she thought was important that would be going on, and she would write all this down. And every time I got the answers, whenever I went on board one of the crafts.
Do you remember some of those questions?
Well, for instance, I asked us some of the questions. For instance, where do you come from? And the Grays told me they were from a planet called Grace Send, as in S-E-N-D, you know. So they said everything in the world that is created from vibrations. Even the gravity bonding, the existence of matter itself is created from a vibrational context. So when everything it comes together, it's a vibration. And it's some vibrations are higher, some vibrations are lower. But everything that is named by them is named after something that is in existence or makes sense. So that what they do is they name their planet after what they are, their gray race from... They're sent from that planet to here, so they're called Grayson, is where their world is.
They didn't tell you where that was, so what star system?
No, actually, see, that at the time I was fairly young when I asked
that
question.
Yeah, I understand that. Now, there's no doubt about it that you're for lack of a better term, a hybrid, right? I mean, there was you told me an interesting
story.
Well,
in 1954, UFO lands in my mom's backyard. Less than a year later, I was born. She wound up in a divorce and lost the farm and everything over it because her husband had thought she'd cheated on her while he was doing his tour in the Navy. But there was nobody else around, and everybody knew my mom was a very faithful, wonderful woman. But she couldn't explain the pregnancy. In fact, she didn't know it at the time.
Yeah, that's what I wanted to get into, was that part of it. The ramifications of I'm glad you mentioned the divorce and everything, because a lot of people don't think about all of the personal things that happen to these women when this happens. I mean, you know, she was pregnant, she didn't know about it, and I want to get into that part of the story. She was ill, and they went to the hospital, and they actually cut her open. And
yeah, they actually thought that I was a tumor before I was born because I had no heartbeat. The doctor couldn't see. Back in them days, they had all these fancy machines to tell you about heartbeats. It was either a pulse or they would listen to it with the stethoscope to see if they could find a heartbeat. I guess the doctor that examined my mother actually threw his stethoscope in the garbage, thinking it was a piece of junk. Maybe it was faulty, or I don't know. But all I know is that he opened my mother up thinking I was a tumor and found out she was pregnant.
And so they sewed her back up, and she had a natural birth later.
That's right.
A lot of times... You get to see the ETs come back to see what's happening. You get visited often or not?
Well, I've been on back and forth on board those things so many times I can't count them. But I do know that every time I went, my mother would say, you know, if they're friendly, you know, ask them about this.
But as
this,
an adult, you haven't that. Been. Have you been
as an adult? Yes, they've been coming. They've got a device in me that tracks me. In fact, I have a certain way I can bring them down, and I found out how I can make them come down and talk to me, and it's an unusual way to do it. Is what I do is I run 120 volts straight through my body for maybe an hour.
Yeah, you saw me. You demonstrated to me yesterday. He plugged in. You saw that too, Roberta. He plugged his thing into the wire with the two into the wall there, and you took a volt.
Right straight for the mall, yeah.
Yeah, and that doesn't bother you?
No, electricity has no effect on me.
You don't even feel it?
No.
Not at all?
Nothing. But what it does do is it messes with the tracking device that they placed in my head, And anytime a master race thinks that their technology is above another, and they think there's that is working superiorly, and they've been using it, and then all of a sudden they run across somebody that this technology begins to malfunction, the first thing they're going to do is come and check out what's wrong with their technology. So they didn't come here for me. So by malfunctioning their technology, I actually can bring spaceships down.
Now, when you were talking to me earlier before we came on the air here, You told me that you're the cousin of Travis Walton. You just mentioned it, but you actually ended up in Snowflake with a truck driver.
That was pure accident. At the time Travis was abducted, yes, they were looking for me. I think they took him by mistake, and he doesn't realize what a great honor it would be to be picked up by those people because, you know,
Travis thinks it was a pretty scary, horrible thing.
Well, see, a lot of people UFO. I'd like to get this point out to all the UFO abductees that have been visited time and time again. Now, people think that they're paralyzed in fear, but this is not true. What is the paralyzation? You see, a tracking device has four main purposes. This is what the aliens explained to me. They said the first purpose is immobilization of the central nervous system by shooting a pulse directly into the brain, which causes a shutdown of the body's nerve system, which actually allows them to come and go without you picking up a knife or trying to hurt them because you're in fear or whatnot. Well, people think they're paralyzed in fear, but what they really don't know is they're not paralyzed because of the fear. They're paralyzed because of the technology that's been implanted in them before on their visitations. Now, the second one is communication. The same way that you talk on a cell phone, well, this, you see a crystal, you put a little electricity to it, you got a radio. Well, this device that they put in your head is like a crystal, and the electronic impulses of your brain power it for short-wave radio frequencies, and they can talk to you from their brain to your brain by bypassing the eardrums. So by doing this, they can communicate, and it sounds like telepathy, mind over matter, but that's not what it is. It's simply technology.
Okay, and you have a couple other reasons?
Oh, yes. Yes, the two other reasons are tracking, of course.
Yeah.
And then the other one is distress. If you're ever in distress or you're having problems, and they kind of mark you like a.
So in other words,
they come and check on you.
You feel like you have ET protection.
You're under a protection. They're kind of like guardian angels.
You were at hitchhiking, I guess, to Hollywood at. You never made it, I don't think. I think you only made it as far as needles. But you're kind of an entertainer, a very talented guy, and I can't let you off of here without singing this abduction song.
Well, I've been busy with aliens all my life, and I sometimes, whenever the aliens would pick me up, you know how people are friendly and everything. So I made up a song about them, and because I saw what's going on and everything, and so I just kind of put it together.
Well,
you
don't have your guitar with you, but let's do it anyway.
All right, but
you feel up to it?
If you got to plug your ears, because I'm not really that great of a singer, but it's the song and the message
bad.
that you want to listen to.
Yeah, right. It wasn't bad. He's a pretty good lyricist, folks. Listen to this. This is Don. Go ahead and do it, and we'll do a formal intro
all
later.
All right, this song's going to get out, and it's going to go. All the kids loved it. See, my girlfriend, she'd ask me to play it for them constantly.
Do you have a name for this song?
Yes, I call it the Alien Song.
The Alien Song. Okay, this is Don Walton and the Alien Song.
It's kind of the flip side of that, this land is your land.
Okay,
thing, you know?
It's kind of a takeoff.
Okay, so it goes, this land is your land, this land ain't my land, 'cause I'm an alien from another planet. I fly above you in a super spacecraft. This land was made for you, not me. We teach your pigeons to crap upon you. We show them how to hit your cars. And while you're cursing at that car wash, you'll never know that crap's from Mars. This land is your land. This land ain't my land, 'cause I'm an alien from another planet. I fly above you in a super spacecraft. This land was made for you, not me. We change your weather We make it rotten, so all you humans wrap up in cotton. You freeze your butts off and blame your God. This land was made for you, not me. This land is your land. This land ain't my land. 'Cause I'm an alien from another planet. I fly above you in a super spacecraft. This land was made for you, not me. So we pretended that we was God. Burned 10 commandments that Moses saw. He made religion. Man, what a pigeon. This land was made for you, not me. That's not over yet.
You got more, don't you?
Last part. Last
part. You're there, right?
All right. We taught you humans how to make a bomb. And with religion, them wars were on. And if you wipe your own butts out, you're just one less problem for us to worry about. This land was made for you, not me.
Yeehaw! Yeah, that's Dan Walton.
Don Walton.
Instead of Dan, sorry about that. Don Walton, and we got about a minute left here. I want to ask you, your ET friends, your benefactors, are they traditionally, are they grays or what?
Well,
or do
yes,
you know what they
gray,
look like?
But there are red ones, too.
Red ones?
Yes.
Well, we've had...
The red ones are a more reptilian-looking, snake-like creature.
Okay.
But they're still friendly towards me because I don't fight them. See, one thing an Inebeti should know is that when you're under control of this technology, that the more you fight, it's just harder on you. But if you don't fight them and you don't represent a threat to them, if you just accept them and try to communicate with them, they will teach you things. They will give you things, gifts, and things that... you know, you will use along the way. In fact, the gifts they gave me is the book that I wrote called The Coming, Human Aliens, Fact or Fiction. And Fate Magazine is looking at it to review it right now. In fact...
You were right to the top. I saw you talking to Phyllis Galdi about it.
Yeah.
And she seemed interested.
Well, after the demonstration, the lady publisher didn't have no choice but to ask for a book because she said it's just impossible for a person to do that. In fact, I did that in front of the man who was from the FBI here. He was a retired FBI, and he said I was trying to scam people, saying I was a hybrid and all that. Well, I showed him. I plugged myself directly in the wall. Then he went out in his truck and got a meter and put it on me, and he said, well, the juice is there. He said, but maybe the meter's bad. He says, can you arc those together? When I arced them together, he bought a book.
He did?
Yeah.
You mentioned red beings. Could they be orange instead of red? The reason I ask that because Linda Cowan.
Well, see, when you're
Linda
when
Cowan
you're
did
under
this documentary
of a
up in Idaho,
device,
where you're from. And,
you got to understand it. Whenever the brain is interfered with, okay, you have to understand this. Whenever the brain is interfered with, and you're under the immobilization of a tracking device, you got to be you're going to be a little distorted, like you've been drinking booze or like you've been drunk. This is what the abductees are going to feel after they come back. They're going to feel like they've been drunk or drugged. And they haven't neither. They've just been interfered with as far as their central nervous system is and the brain pulse enters that little electricity that they shoot out, that little pulse. Okay, but what you really ought to know the most is that when you come back, you're going to feel disorientated. You're going to be drunk. You're going to... What you fear the most, like burning your finger, is going to affect you more than finding a $20 bill. You'll forget about it a few days later, but you always remember you burnt your finger. So when you fear something, you remember it more than you would anything. It burns it into the situation. But when you're disorientated and you see aliens and your fear overrides their ability to mesmerize you or hypnotize you that they weren't there, then they appear elusive or transparent. You can actually, it's like you're seeing through them, but you're not really seeing through them. What it is your memory is clouded that they tried to block out, but you're getting visions of when you were in fear, the parts, and they seem elusive and transparent. In other words,
so you're proud to be a hybrid, I think.
Well, see, I believe that everything in life was meant to be, and everybody's created for a purpose. I think my purpose was to connect the human race with the aliens.
Dom Walton's been our guest. Thanks very much. Our time's up. This is Jerry Pippin. Our on-location producer is Roberta Scott. And our technical editor is Jay Swartley. Until next time, cheers.
The year was 1970 when Jack Blanchard and Misty Morgan released their first big single hit, Tennessee Birdwalk. For the first time in the history of music, this 45 RPM single becomes available to the public in the form of a mouse pad. Made of high-quality quarter-inch rubber, this fabric-covered 8-inch mouse pad delivers your mouse a very smooth ride. For only $9.95 plus $2.50 shipping and handling, your mouse pad will be rushed via USPS first-class mail. Simply click on the happy little mice and be directed to our ordering page. Hurry while this limited time offer lasts.